Hi, and welcome to Designed for Life, the podcast that brings design and technology teachers and business leaders from across the UK together as we collectively seek to inspire, energize, and create the workforce of the future.
Hi, and welcome to the latest edition of Designed for Life, the podcast brought to you by the Design and Technology Association. My name's Tony Ryan. I'm Chief Executive of the Association. And in this latest episode, we get to talk to Pim van Baarten. Pim is CEO of the Silverstone Technology Cluster, a cluster, as the name suggests, of over 120 high-tech industries within an hour's drive of the Silverstone race circuit. I found out during the course of the interview that originally, the majority of businesses involved were race-orientated, motorsport-orientated, but this is now around 20-25% with high-tech moving in and taking over the majority of the cluster's work at the moment. So I'd like to thank again the Edge Foundation, who without their help, this podcast would not be possible. So thank you for all your support there. And I hope you enjoy this episode as we try and bring the worlds of education and business and high tech closer together. Okay, so welcome to Design for Life. This morning I'm here with Pim van Baarten, CEO of the Silverstone Technology Cluster. Good morning, Pim.
Good morning.
Stack of questions for you here this morning because you've got an interesting background and I think you've got an incredibly interesting job. So lots and lots that I want to ask you. As I do with all of the podcasts, I'm going to go right away back and take you right away back to the Netherlands and just ask you about what was school like for you? What was your education like?
Honestly, pretty standard. I was a pretty normal kid. I didn't get into trouble too much, just a little bit like normal kids do. Usual report cards, you know, not bad by any stretch of the imagination, but could do better. Citation was always there. You know, a little bit of a dreamer sometimes with everything outside being more interesting than what's happening in the classroom type stuff. But yeah, on the whole, you know, reasonably well-behaved and reasonably, how do you say that, studious or working well.
Okay, that's good. And you went on then, you've got two bachelor's degrees in international business and marketing. Mm. I'm just interested, why the need for two? Why did you feel that you had to do a second one there?
I'm not sure I felt there was a real need to do two, but when I went to effectively the university in Holland, they actually offered a double degree program with the second degree being done in partnership with Plymouth University. They actually have three universities that they do that with, so one in France, one in Germany, and one in England. I knew I wanted to end up in England, so I wanted to qualify and do the Plymouth degree because I thought if I'm going to work in England, it'll be more helpful or additionally helpful to also have a degree that is recognized from a recognized UK university. So it was kind of less about me wanting that experience and wanting to move to the UK about going, oh, well, I must have two degrees. You know, if it turned out it was one degree that also had the Plymouth University name on it, I would have been perfectly happy with that. But that's how it worked out.
You went on to do your master's as well then. That was at the same time. That was in the Netherlands as well.
So that was a partnership program as well between my university in Amsterdam and Plymouth University, where you kind of do half of it in Amsterdam and half of it in Plymouth.
Okay, so you were moving backwards and forwards.
Yes, I have moved backwards and forwards in that time, yeah. So the double degree program as well was that the entire third year of the four-year course we actually did in Plymouth.
Right. Okay. So you knew at an early age that you wanted to move to the UK?
Yeah. So in Holland, you're in a position, and it might be different now, but certainly at the time, the schools in Holland are quite sort of career focused. So it's kind of like, if you want to be a doctor, that's your path. If you want to be a farmer, that's your path. If you want to be a carpenter, that's your path type thing. And so from relatively early on, it's kind of like, well, what do you want to do career wise? Because you need to pick your school path, so to speak. And I always wasn't very sure until I saw, I think it was like the Monaco Grand Prix or something that I saw, and I went, oh, that's cool. I'll do that then. And clearly not realizing what was involved. But looking at that more and finding my passion for motorsport and the engineering and all that sort of stuff led me to look into it a bit more, then discovered that basically this area in the UK is an absolutely fantastic hotbed for all of that. And so it became very clear to me that if I wanted to have a career in this area, then this is an absolutely fantastic place to do that. And so I set my sights on doing that.
That is interesting because most students that I've worked with, there's very few that actually decide at a very early age, that's where I'm going to go. And quite a lot get stressed at 17, 18, that they still haven't worked out what it is that they want to do with their lives. And I always said to them as a teacher, you've got a long career ahead of you, whatever it might be. Don't worry, it'll come, it'll find you. I mean, motorsport found you possibly through what? I mean, who wouldn't look at Monaco Grand Prix and think, yeah, that looks sexy. I fancy that. But, you know, that's a thing that a lot of students do worry about, is that they feel that at 14, they should have their career mapped out in front of them. It doesn't work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't work that way. I think because there's lots of different routes and lots of different paths. I mean, the job that I'm doing now, I absolutely love and I think it's absolutely fantastic. But even 5 years ago, the job didn't exist. So yeah. How could I possibly known that I would have ended up wanting to do this job? And so I don't think you need to be sort of as specific as that. And certainly don't map out your career because there's lots of different factors that might change things. But what I would say, and what I do hope lots of young people do, and I hope that a lot of teachers can encourage them to do that, is find the thing that works for you. You know, find the thing that switches you on. You know, I worked together with a guy who wasn't particularly good at school and was kind of like one of the trouble kids at school, but he happened to come across a professional kitchen that switched him on, worked his way up from basically a pot washer, and ultimately he became the private chef on the Gucci family yacht, traveling the world for a couple of years. And with the money that he made there, he founded his own restaurant, which is now a Michelin starred restaurant. And so here's a guy who was a troublesome kid, and you know, he wasn't going to do particularly well in the system. But he found his thing and, you know, really went for it and obviously achieved great things. And I think looking at what that thing is for you and what works for you, try to find that. Try to find the area that I want to be in. My dad had his own construction company and me and my brother worked at an early age with him. And my brother loved it and really took to it. And kind of I didn't really think it was for me and I just didn't take to it. And so it's kind of like one area where I kind of like, well, I don't think construction is for me, so let's look for something else. And, you know, I've had lots of different jobs as a youngster. And if nothing else, it helps you to eliminate what isn't working for you. And it helps you to find, hey, this area is for me and I'm quite interested in that and I want to do more. And then pursue that and go for it. So don't worry about mapping out a career, but try to find that thing that really switches you on and works for you and then go for that.
I've heard you say in other podcasts that I've listened that you've done that you said along the lines of find something that you love and you never work a day in your life. I mean, you've mentioned a few times just how much you love what you're doing at the moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's because I was quite fortunate to find that thing that really switched me on. And I managed to develop that and sort of go for that. And it's worked out. And I'm incredibly grateful and happy for that. But it does make a big difference. And I think, you know, if you're going to commit to doing something for a very large chunk of your life, which is obviously your career, then make sure it's something that you're happy doing. And even if it's not necessarily a career, because maybe you find that actually the thing that you want to do is raise a family and, you know, be a fantastic mom or dad for your children or whatever it may be, then if that's your thing, then pursue that and do a great job on doing that. And get that fulfillment, you know, try to do something that fulfills you and that excites you and that you're happy about, whatever that may be. I don't think anybody can sort of specify that for you. It's for you to discover what makes you happy and what drives you to then pursue that.
I couldn't agree more. It's got to pay the bills, but it's also got to make your heart sing because you're going to spend an awful lot of time doing it.
Yeah.
If I go back in 2000, you moved to the UK then and you fulfilled this dream of working with motorsport, working with the Motorsport Industry Association. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, about the move? I mean, first of all, it's a big move. You'd had a little dip in by the sounds of things, moving to Plymouth backwards and forwards, but it's a big move to change country as well, take up your first role, major role in a different country. How was that?
Yeah, it was interesting. I kind of just went for it and didn't really think about it too much. I think because I kind of committed to that, I really wanted to end up in the UK. So when that arrived and I got that opportunity from Chris at the MIA, I was kind of like, well, fantastic. And kind of just really went for it and, you know, tried to find a place and engage with the work and all that sort of stuff. So I think I took it more in a sort of excitement type of mood as opposed to an apprehensive type of mood. And I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to miss my family, I'm going to miss my friends and all that sort of stuff. But more as in, yeah, you know, this is a step towards where I wanted to be. And, you know, the opportunity to move to England, which I always felt I was going to end up, is here now. And that's fantastic. So very much a great, it's here. Let's go and make it happen.
Embraced it.
Yeah.
Your next role took you to work for a now, I'm sort of interested here. Your background now, obviously, your education is international business, marketing, and you've taken on a role here with a very sort of niche sector, by the looks of things, looking at Xtrak, which is looking at transmission specialists.
Yeah.
How much technical knowledge did you need to have to be in that situation? Because I know, again, going back to students, a lot of students will say, well, I can't work in that sector because I don't know enough about it. Did you have to learn stuff in order to do that job?
So this is quite interesting. So this actually came up at my interview at the place where basically the guy said, look, you know, I really like you. And because I knew them previously from my role at the MIA. And he's kind of like, you know, my one concern with you, Pim, is that you're not an engineer. Yeah. And I went, don't worry about that. That is a massive advantage. And he was like, how is that a massive advantage? We're an engineering company. What are you talking about? And it was like, well, Peter, I already know I don't know the answer. So I'm not going to try and flim-flam my way around a question or a technical query that comes away with whatever limited technical knowledge I might have. If somebody comes to me with a technical question, I will find the most appropriate person within this business to help him answer that question and put the two in touch and liaise it that way. And he was kind of like, wow, that's a really good answer. And he hired me.
He didn't see that answer coming. That was a clever answer for a difficult interview question.
But it works, though, because if you think about it, I mean, a particular customer, they're looking for the answer. They're not looking for the answer from you. They're looking for the answer. And what I did, because I looked after their sports car activities, I mean, quite often somebody came to me with a technical query and I put him in touch with the guy who designed their gearbox. And it's kind of like, well, if he doesn't know the answer to your question, there isn't one. And the teams really appreciated that. They were kind of like, okay, great. You know, I've got the answer that I was looking for. And whether the person Pim provides that answer or the person John provides that answer, they don't really mind. They've got the answer they were looking for.
That makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. You then joined Haymarket as a group marketing manager. A big role, a very big role, and one that you probably could have stayed in for a long time. How did you find that step from where you were at Xtrak into Haymarket?
Yeah, it was quite interesting because it was a different dynamic because I worked within Xtrak, within like the commercial team, which is a relatively small team. And, you know, each individual manager looks after sort of each individual area whilst supporting each other. And at Haymarket, I all of a sudden was in charge of several teams myself, which was quite interesting for different shows. But I think, you know, the grounding at the MIA and Xtrak as well, in terms of the marketing and project management and the running of campaigns, was kind of like all there. And so I was in a quite good position, I feel, to sort of guide the teams and help them and do a lot of that stuff. And it was really interesting because it was the first time as well to go into a really big company. And so it took some adjusting and it was a different way of working. But I found it really interesting and I met some absolutely fantastic people there that became really good friends and I really enjoyed it. But it was a step change and it was different. But it's one of those things that, you know, you just got to embrace it and work with it and give it your best shot.
You moved from there then, you moved on and you co-founded your own marketing company, CMA. And that got up and running, you got that going. And then the offer came to work as CEO of the Silverstone Technology Cluster. I'm just interested, I mean, that must have been an offer that was difficult to turn down. It looks like a great role. It looks like the ability to build there is something that you've got within your DNA, is that building things excites you. Is that what drew you to the role?
Yeah, so that's actually really interesting because I suppose my initial reaction, even if I didn't verbalize it, when they rang me, I was kind of like, well, I already have a job, thank you. But thinking about it more, and I think maybe I discovered I'm a little bit more soppy than I thought I was. But I was like, hang on, I've actually been given a role here where I could play a role in helping grow and work within and really help expand the area that even as a young boy, I identified I wanted to be in. So yeah, it did come into a, wow, you know, that's actually something quite special that, you know, back when I was 12, 13 or whatever it was, and I went, hey, this area in the UK is where I need to be, to then be offered an opportunity to play a role within the growth of that and promotion of that, was one of those, you know, upon reflection, where I was like, hey, wow, this is actually really quite interesting. And so, yeah, so I did embrace that. And you're right, it was too good to reject.
Just checking for people that don't know, I haven't heard of the Silverstone Technology Cluster. I mean, it is working with high tech, not just with motorsport, but across high tech industry completely, I believe, looking from Oxford, Milton Keynes, Cambridge, but spanning out as far as Birmingham, Reading, and even touching on London. Can you tell us a little bit more about the cluster itself, how many people are in it, and exactly what is the purpose of the cluster?
Yes, of course I can. So the Silverstone Technology Cluster, geographically speaking, is effectively like an hour's driving time from Silverstone. So it encompasses the area that you mentioned. So it's that sort of geographical area right in the middle of England. Research that was conducted in 2016 identified there were roughly 4,000 companies involved in advanced engineering, electronics, and software. And they very much form a cluster in that. Interestingly, it's not actually a motorsport cluster, as you just indicated, because actually it's far beyond that. Even though a lot of the companies within the cluster are motorsport companies by origin, they've since all diversified into different markets and different sectors. And so actually it's truly a multi-sectorial cluster, which is quite unique. And motorsport is only about 20% of it now, which is a surprise to some. And obviously the Silverstone name, you know, people know it for the track and racing, right? So motorsport is an obvious lead to go to, but actually it's expanded beyond that now. So there's a very high concentration of highly innovative businesses in the area, you know, working across multiple sectors and across multiple things. And even to the point where in the research, people were asked like a magic carpet question, because they're like, hey, you have your business here and that's great, but if your partner could have the same jobs and your kids could go to the same quality school and you could have the same nice house, but you could take all of that and put it anywhere in the world for the benefit of your business, where would you go to? And when they did a similar sort of research in Cambridge, a lot of the responses, or the majority of the responses there, were East or West Coast America. But here, when they asked the question here, virtually everybody said here. So as identified by the people within it, this is the best place in the world for advanced engineering. And so the power of that, plus some of the other stuff that came out of the research where there was like a real need for an organization to foster this, led to the founding of the Silverstone Technology Cluster. And really, so we're a cluster support organization. So we're a not-for-profit organization. We're here to help those advanced engineering businesses in the area. And we do that on methodology that is very similar to what Cambridge Wireless do for the Wireless Communications Cluster in Cambridge, where the three main focuses are promotion, support, and thought leadership. So promotion is the cluster as a whole, but also all the companies within that. Support is really about business growth and helping companies prosper and grow and move to the next level and scale up. And then thought leadership is where we have special interest groups to bring people together around different areas of technologies so they can discuss that and learn of each other and collaborate. And so we're here to help the businesses, and we're here to help encourage people to collaborate and grow. And that's a short summary of it, I think.
That's cool. How many companies in the cluster at the moment, roughly?
We have 120 members at the moment.
120, okay. Next one is a hard question to ask, really, because I don't know if anybody knows the answer to this at the moment, but the pandemic has hit manufacturing possibly harder than other sectors. How do you view the recovery, and what role is the cluster taking in assisting your members at the moment?
So obviously the pandemic is a very tough situation for everybody, and nobody's been left unaffected. What's quite interesting, though, is that what we saw is, first of all, we conducted a bit of a campaign where, if you may recall, there was a real need for PPE within the NHS, and especially for the Northamptonshire, or the NHS Northamptonshire Trust was one of those. And actually, we put out a call for our members to see if they could help, and we coordinated an effort to try to get PPE into NHS Northamptonshire. And so we did that, and we conducted that, and that was really interesting. And it was really good to see how many of our members were like willing to help and like retooled their operations and things. We had a number of different members as well getting involved in the Ventilator UK challenge, where they switched from making engine components to ventilator components and things like that. So that was all very interesting to see and really worthwhile. And then also when we conducted a survey, we actually found that, yes, obviously it had an impact, but I don't think it was as negative as it could have been. And very, very few people made anybody redundant. Not even that many companies put staff on furlough. I mean, obviously, there was a fair chunk of it, but you would expect that to be the majority, and it wasn't. It was only about a third. And so the outcome of it was probably less negative than I anticipated it to be. And I think it really stems from the fact that a lot of the companies within our membership are very agile and very resilient and kind of very used to having a situation thrust upon them and then identifying the opportunities within that and dealing with it and managing with it. And I think that really came to the fore. And so that was really quite interesting to see. I mean, I think in terms of getting out of it and things, I mean, I think there's still a long way to go. I mean, for a lot of our members, they're seeing business come back and I hear positive stories. But of course, there is still a lot of uncertainty out there and still a lot of, you know, yes, business is coming in, but is that a one-off blip or is that the return of good times?
Yeah.
You know, what we're trying to do, as always, I mean, we're always looking to bring people together and encourage them to collaborate. We've also run a series of webinars with useful information and useful advice and things. We set up an online forum. So there's quite a few initiatives that we've done as an organization to help members, and we'll obviously continue to do that. And, you know, always happy to work with members and help them with their individual needs as well where we can. But I think there's not necessarily more to come, but it'd be a while before we'll manage to shake this off and progress from it. So we're not out of the woods yet.
That's an encouraging story, though. These companies are agile by nature, and therefore this is another challenge that, yes, there's certain parts of their sector, certain parts of the business may have died, but other opportunities have come up which they've shifted to. I think you and I first met because of the PPE. That was the first conversation that we had, because we were trying to link up schools as well to do work with it. And I think we had a telephone call months ago, March, April, where we were looking at joining the whole thing up. Just the quotation taken from your website: innovation is the driver of economic growth. I don't think anyone's going to argue with that at all, but innovation is also often risky and expensive. How do companies manage that dichotomy of having to take chances in order to break new borders, in order to create new growth?
Well, it's hard, of course, as you say, but a lot of our companies are sort of very much in the prototyping and pre-production phase. And quite often, a lot of them get commissioned to do so. So there's like a big OEM that would engage them to help them with a particular area. So there's a number of members that fit into that category. There's also a number of members that operate with grant funding to develop new things. And of course, there's a number of them that then go out with sort of good ideas and good innovation suggestions and get private funding for that, either by sort of companies or even angel investors and things, and progress it from there. So it is hard and it can be expensive, but I think a number of our members have proven very adept in sort of identifying routes to market for it, or routes to funding, if you will. It's something that we're trying to help them with as well. And one of our longer term ambitions is to set up an angel investor network for the cluster as well. You know, if you're in the business of being innovative technologically, quite often you're also quite innovative when it comes to finding the money and the resources to do so. And I think a number of our members have been quite successful with that.
It's one of the issues. I mean, our subject, the qualifications have changed really to push students into innovating and actually looking at real problems and solution to real problems. And one of the difficulties for many kids is that quite often that will result in a lot of failure. And it's not looking upon it as failure, but as learning. You know, things will go wrong when you're innovating, when you're pushing, when you're trying something new. You're going to get it wrong 10 times before you get it right. And just trying to educate students that that's the way of the world.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because realistically, in innovation, there is no real failure, I don't think. You know, you just discover ways on how not to do it.
Yeah.
And so the search for the way on how to do it continues. And that's kind of the challenge. And I think if you let yourself get down by that, it's going to be also tough, because a great part of learning is finding out how not to do stuff. So whenever you try something and it doesn't work, then it's kind of like, right, you've learned that that doesn't work. So think about how you can make it work next. So yeah, that resilience is going to be a big part of it. And I think you really need to view it as that. All of it is stepping stones towards the ultimate success. And, you know, keep pushing towards that ultimate success and don't worry about any missteps, because any misstep encourages you to take a step in the right direction, because you've just discovered that that's not the way to go. So you need to go another way. And all of it helps to guide you to where you ultimately want to be.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, and that's been a big step for our subject. And also prototyping. You mentioned there a minute ago that we used to think that you have to come up with a solution at the end of 6 months, 12 months of study, that there had to be a solution that was finished, that was working. We're now in a position where a prototype may be a step towards a solution. It might not be the whole way. And that's a mind shift. That's a whole change of attitude.
Yeah, I think also what's important to remember, especially when you go into this sort of area, the very nature of engineering is continuous improvement. So the moment you've come up with something and you've made something and it's beautiful and it's good, the engineer within you will find ways to make it, you know, stronger, lighter, cheaper, faster, whatever the requirement is. So there's always a continuous moving target. And that doesn't mean that you should stop pursuing it. It just means that there's iterations and, you know, all of those steps and all of those iterations all work towards the future goal. So I don't think you should view it as a negative, because even if you do manage to get upon the perfect solution and create it, then beautiful, well done. But undoubtedly, within moments, you will find a way that you could do it slightly better.
I get to go, as part of my work, I'm fortunate to get to go to see exhibitions of students' work, and you get A-level students that have presented something, which is wonderful. But 95% of them will say, if you gave me another 6 months, there's another three things that I would do that I would make this even better. And they're in that mindset already that they want to improve it all the time. So
that's the competitive engineering mindset, right? You know, it can always be better and you can always improve stuff. So yeah, see it as steps towards it. Don't see it as failure. Just see it as steps towards it.
You're listening to Designed for Life. This podcast has been made possible through the support of our friends at The Edge Foundation, helping all young people to achieve their potential.
Can I ask you a little bit? You mentioned a short while ago here about the special interest groups, and I picked some stuff off your website, which was talking about automotive, mobility, AI, machine learning, manufacturing, wearable technology, which is really interesting as well. Those groups, is that a little bit of a sort of crystal ball time where you're looking and trying to work out where the sector's going, where that technology could move to?
Yeah, there's an element of that. So the special interest groups, basically the way they work is that obviously we work together with our members, but effectively any of our member can come to me with any suggestion for any special interest group on particular areas that need that. We then sort of have a conversation on how to do it. We invite everybody from the cluster who wants to and who has an interest in it to participate and have a conversation about, you know, what the group would do and how it would work and how would it add value and all that sort of stuff. But inevitably, we end up with groups where we essentially have a relatively small committee of people who work within that field, and they organize events. And at those events, it's all about, okay, you know, what do people need to know about when they're working in this area? You know, what is the latest technology? You know, is there legislation? Are there collaborative projects? Is there funding? What is happening in this space that you really need to be aware of? And so the groups that we have, and, you know, one of us is on autonomous, connected, electrified and shared. So very much a future mobility space. And, you know, we look at all sorts of stuff in there. And then the beauty of the events is that, you know, we invite a speaker and there's a couple of people who come around and then they sit there as clap cattle to just go, oh, well, wasn't that interesting? It's much more than that. You know, the speakers tend to be sort of fairly controversial or, you know, give their opinion. So it's not the corporate marketing pitch that they're giving, it's their views and their thoughts. And then a lot of the time, and we encourage this and we build it into the program, there's the opportunity for people to respond and interact. And so we get a bit of an open forum going, because it's through this sort of debate and through this sort of conversation that, you know, you really learn and you bring these people together and everybody gains out of it. So that's very much the setup of the groups. And that's very much why we try to do them, to encourage this people to get together and collaborate and learn from one another.
It sounds fab. They sound great.
It is really good fun. And we've got some fantastic presentations within that. Very thought-provoking.
It's the sort of thing that we try to do at A-level, where you will take a controversial stance on something and just have a discussion around it and just see what springs out from that. But it sounds like a larger scale version of that, which is perfect for innovation, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've had some fascinating presentations with, you know, people talking about what future cities will look like. I remember one special interest group where we had the guy who actually invented 5G to do a presentation there as well, which is fascinating as well, of course. And then I remember one particular group where we had somebody fairly senior from Volkswagen saying that they've already finished their last ever diesel engine and they just started their last ever ICE engine because everything was going to go electrical. And yeah, it's those sort of presentations and those sort of discussions that are really quite fascinating and everybody gets a lot out of that. It's really great to see where the future goes and, you know, learn about what's happening in your area.
I can see why you like your job, sitting in on those conversations. You mentioned a short while ago that finding the funding, finding the right angel investor in order to enable this innovation to happen is a key part of that process. Does government understand the economic need for innovation and what more could be done to support small companies that are working in tech and are breaking boundaries there?
The simple answer to your question is yes, I think they do. And it's something that they try to encourage. So there's things like R&D tax credits and things like that, which are obviously very useful. And I know that a lot of our members are engaged with them and things. So I do think the government get it. I do think it's quite difficult to implement, though, because what we do get is that funding is a very fragmented landscape, and it's sometimes quite difficult to identify who you should call or who you should approach for which particular project and things. So that's quite hard, and especially if you're in the day-to-day running and, you know, you've got 80 things on your desk that require your attention, to then spend some time investigating who the right person is to engage for a particular bit of funding, you know, you don't always have time for that. So it can be difficult and it can be sort of time consuming, but obviously it can be very worthwhile as well. I think the government is looking all the time to try to help with that. And then if you look at, you know, local enterprise partnerships, they've got a lot of programs in place as well and funding rounds as well. So I do think there's quite a lot of stuff out there. It won't always be the easiest to find and the easiest to find what is the most appropriate for you, which is a bit of a shame. And, you know, if there was a particular way of streamlining that, I think that would be quite good. I've also had members ask that, you know, yes, R&D tax credits are fantastic, but what about something like capital tax credits, where, for instance, encourages people to invest more in new machinery and all that sort of stuff? That could be quite good. So hopefully that's something that's going to be considered in the future. But I think there's a reasonable understanding there. We're working a fair bit with government as well to try to build out that understanding. And we've set up a roundtable discussion group for a number of our members with LEPs, but also some MPs and things to try and forge that link and basically increase those bonds between sort of government and industry, where government gets a real feedback on what it's like out there for the SMEs out there, you know, the advanced engineering SMEs. So there's a fair amount of stuff that we do, but, you know, I have to say that, you know, the government are supportive and I do think they get it. But obviously there's quite a lot on at the moment, right?
Yeah, there certainly is. There certainly is. Again, back to your website, you've got sort of next steps. You've got the priorities where you are now, and you've got your next steps on there. One of the next steps is recognizing the lack of engineers in the UK and the lack of students going into engineering, specifically in manufacturing and tech sectors, as being an issue. Is the cluster doing any work on that? And how do you think we encourage young people to look at this? Because I have to admit, I was a secondary head teacher and I had no idea. Design and technology was my subject as I came through school. I had no idea of some of the jobs that are out there until I started doing the job that I do now and see some stuff and just think, wow, I wouldn't have known that existed if I hadn't have done the job that I do. So teachers out there are not going to know about the opportunity, so therefore students won't know about the opportunities. And I'm just wondering how we break this, because there are so many great jobs out there, but I don't think the kids know about them.
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing, because I think that's the primary problem. And in reality, it's ironically, it's a marketing exercise. You know, one of the things that we do is that we work together with Silverstone Park, who set up sort of an innovation educational program, where we and they and a lot of our members sort of go into schools and give presentations and do networking and all that sort of stuff to raise the profile. And I myself, I mean, I've done a number of presentations with different schools. And what I talk about is basically the cluster. And I talk about, you know, the companies that are within it. And actually, the way I kind of talk about it is, you know, I first put up a slide with like all the Formula One teams and like the Pro Drives and the JLRs and all the big names, and kind of go like, look, all of these guys are based here. And if you're anywhere even vaguely interested in engineering, you will know that. So I'm not going to talk about any of those guys, right? Because you'll already be switched on to those guys. Instead, I'm going to talk to you about all those guys that you've never heard of that do the most amazing things that you should want to be a part of. And then I talk about a number of our members. There's guys that make water-repellent carbon nano-coatings. There's guys that have built their own EV from scratch for testing. There's guys that do batteries. There's some really big name OEMs ring them to say, hey, we want to show the world how good we are at making this particular car. And then basically they pick the color and give these guys the money and they end up with a fantastic car out of it. And again, these are all companies that nobody's ever heard of. Sounds really hard, but it's like they're not big names. They're not well known out there, but yeah. You know, they're fantastic outfits. And I think getting the people to understand that, you know, and they're based here, you know, you could stay living in your mum's house and it's a 15-minute ride.
They're on your doorstep.
This company that made Lizzie Arnold's winning sled, or that company over there that is a further 5 minutes away. And, you know, they helped UKGB win all the cycling medals and all that sort of stuff. And so there's some really amazing stuff out there that is all within reach and it's all within your area. And it's getting that knowledge out there. And then, you know, of course, when I give these presentations, the students kind of go, oh, Jesus, I didn't know that. But then, like you rightly said, the teacher then come back and go like, wow, I didn't know that either. And so for me, it's really like, well, what can we do? And we're trying to work with Southern Park, as I mentioned, but also with other schools and MK University and MK College and things like that, who are members, to try to forge those links, you know, forge more links between industry and academia. And like the Open University are a member of ours as well, which we're very proud of, which is fantastic. And we're trying to work with them as well on that, because I think the more knowledge is out there, you know, with the professors and with the teachers, and then therefore ultimately with the students, on what's available here and how much of a absolutely fantastic hotbed this is of all the really good stuff that is going on, that has got to be one of the main exercises. And it's something that we're actively trying to encourage and work on.
I love what you said right at the start there. I mean, this is essentially a marketing activity, isn't it? It's there, it's existing, it's fab, but 4 miles down the road, somebody doesn't know about it. They need to know about it. And if you can join that up, students are going to jump at it. I think students are not motivated, in my experience, about making huge amounts of money. They're motivated with making a difference. And if they feel that they can work in something that makes a difference to other people's lives, that's a huge motivator.
For the vast majority of advanced engineering companies that we deal with, that's what it's all about. And a lot of them are working on stuff that make real difference and make, you know, lighter, more environmentally friendly, you know, look at new ways of doing things, digitization of the manufacturing process, reducing waste, increasing efficiency, you know, all of that sort of stuff is all featured like so much and so heavily. So if youngsters are interested in that and switched on by that, then absolutely engineering and what our guys do is absolutely for them and should really be on their radar. And, you know, I would be more than happy for anybody listening to this, if they're interested, to reach out to me and let's see what we can do together. Because I think the more we can get children, even at young schools, picking up STEM subjects, the more we can get people engaged in engineering and understand what the opportunities are. And, you know, there's really good career opportunities. And even if it's not all about making money, I mean, you know, some of the engineers out there do make really good living as well. So it's not like you get to be an engineer, but you need to be poor because of it. That doesn't apply either. So, you know, I just want to make sure that people get that it's a really viable career option. And I wish they would consider it, because there's a lot there that can really switch people on and allow them to make a difference and do something great. And it's really exciting stuff. So at least have a look at it and decide if that's one of the things that switches you on. Because I still think that's one of the main things, right? If it switches you on and you get excited by it, you want to do it and you'll excel in it.
Yeah, and you'll find out more about it and you'll go the extra mile in order to talk to somebody about it. Final question, Pim. if there are young people out there listening to this at the moment that are at school that are thinking, well, actually, yeah, that does sound interesting. It sounds like something I want to find more. I want to work in a high-tech sector, maybe. What advice would you give them?
I mean, by all means, go to our website and get in touch with us. You know, very happy to talk to people and make them aware. I mean, maybe even if there's a teacher who's particularly keen for me to do a presentation in their school or something, I'm very happy to do that. But if you're a youngster out there and you want to find out more, is that obviously, you know, reach out to people, but also engage in the activities, right? There's so many engineering opportunities out there, right from, you know, if you want to look from a motorsport point of view, there's the Formula One teams. You know, obviously they get a lot of interest and a lot of CVs and all that sort of stuff. But what they are looking for is not necessarily that, you know, you've got the most perfect grades or whatever, but it's your enthusiasm and your passion for it. So if you're out there in a racetrack and you're helping your mate build a car, or you're always tootling around with your own car or with your own devices, or you're constantly doing stuff, that's what makes a difference. So engage with that, you know, showcase your passion, you know, and just engage in relevant hobbies that emphasize that you're the real deal and this is what you want to do. Because that's what switches them on as well. You know, it's a positive attitude and the engagement and the want for you to want to do it. That is a huge factor in it. And just reach out to everybody. And, you know, maybe even with like a number of the race teams out there, and there's, you know, race teams at all sorts of different levels, and just volunteer and say, hey, you know, I'm keen to help you out for the weekend. Is there something that I can do? And approach people with that, you know, and engage with them. Go after internships and just learn as much as you possibly can to inform yourself and put yourself in a position where people can notice you as somebody who's passionate and deliver the goods.
A lot of the employers that I meet will say exactly what you just said there now. They said, you know, yeah, the qualifications, that'll get your CV on the table. But it's what you do outside of that that really interests us and makes us want to find out more about you. So, yeah, that sounds spot on. Pim, thank you so much for giving up your time this morning. I really do appreciate it. It's been really interesting. You have got a wonderful job. You've got a great job there reaching out with so many people trying to make stuff happen and joining stuff up. And thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a complete pleasure. And I totally agree. I absolutely love my job and I think it's fantastic. So, yeah, I feel very privileged for that. But thank you very much for your time and thank you for having me. And as I said, more than happy to engage with anybody on the subject and what we can do, because I think the more we can get people excited about engineering and what we're doing here in the UK, the better it's going to be for all of us.
Agreed. Cheers, Pim. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you, Tony. That was really great. Thank you.
I'd like to say a huge thank you to Pim van Baarsen for giving up his time to enable us to record that podcast. Something we'll be following up with some of the industries in the cluster over the course of the next year. Again, I'd like to offer my thanks as well to the Edge Foundation for making this podcast series possible through their support. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope there's something there for your school, for your students and for your department. And until the next time, take care.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. If you did, hit the subscribe button now, as we have guests lined up for future pods that will inform, inspire, and entertain. This podcast is brought to you by the Design and Technology Association.